like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
At their last meeting, council approved a bylaw to temporarily prohibit clear-cutting in the midst of several moving pieces surrounding tree protection in the city. Councillor Osanek brought the motion forward. With the intent of pressing pause while council awaits a natural heritage study review, the new official plan, and potential updates to toughen the city's current tree bylaw.
The intent of this bylaw is to prevent any further avoidable loss of woodland canopy in advance of our policies coming forward with the natural heritage study. We had all hoped that the natural heritage study policies would already be before us. It looks like it's going to be not until June now, and that's when the official plan, all those policies should be coming forward. We need these policies for the natural heritage so badly. And so this bylaw is to, take us until that point in time.
There are some exceptions to the law, including permits and approval directly from council. Enforcement of the bylaw will be through administrative monetary penalties, with a base penalty of $5,000 for prohibited clear-cutting, plus $5,000 per 0.1 hectares of trees cleared in contravention of the bylaw. For more serious or repeat offenses, proceedings may be initiated under Part 3 of the Provincial Offenses Act. When asked about enforcement, staff provided the following response to council.
Of course, staff resources are limited, so like most bylaws, we'd be approaching this on a reactive approach. Certainly, if there are complaints from members of the public about alleged clear-cutting activity, those residents are encouraged to reach out to the city's bylaw enforcement division for further investigation.
Councillors supported the motion unanimously, with Councillor Connie Glenn noting the importance of taking time to slow down while the future strategy of protecting the city's tree canopy takes shape.
I do hope that everyone here will support this. I think that this is a reasonable measure. We are in the midst of a lot of change right now. We have seen some things happen that have the community rightly concerned. I'm certainly disheartened and concerned about the fast pace of some of the cutting that we've seen, and without discussion given, I think everyone in the city knows we're in the midst of a new heritage, a natural heritage study review. They know that we're in the middle of an official plan. This is an opportunity for the whole community to slow down and reorient itself to what our future is going to look like. We know that there are high growth demands here, but how do we manage that while preserving the things that we value most? So I hope that everyone sees that this is a reasonable temporary measure to get us to that next stage where we've got clear rules and a clear understanding amongst the entire community about how we move forward.
The temporary ban on clear cutting will remain in effect until the city's new official plan comes into force, or until council otherwise amends or repeals the bylaw. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstel, LJR reporter for the Kingstonist, about how the Napanee Town Council may respond to a proposed high-speed rail line and its potential impact on the community.
Thank you, Dinah. The Council of the Town of Greater Napanee is grappling with how to respond to a proposed high-speed rail line that could impact the region. But, as staff made clear last Tuesday night, the debate is less about whether the project moves forward and more so how it does so. At Council's meeting on Tuesday, April 14th, 2026, Chief Administrative Officer, CAO, Matthew Grant stated that the consultation process is focused on how, not if, the project would be built, a reflection of both Aalto's mandate and federal direction. The statement came earlier in the meeting as the CAO reported back on information gathered at a federal stakeholder consultation in Harrowsmith on March 26th, where he had been directed to collect details on the Aalto High Speed Rail (HSR) project and provide council with a factual report and recommendations. Aalto is the federal crown corporation tasked with designing and consulting on the rail network. However, Aalto does not have the authority to decide whether the line is built or where it ultimately runs. Those decisions rest with the federal government. The proposed HSR line, estimated to cost between $60 and $90 billion, would connect Toronto and Quebec City with trains traveling up to 300 kilometers per hour. In eastern Ontario, planners are considering two possible corridors between Toronto and Ottawa, a northern route following the Highway 7 corridor, or a southern route that could cut through rural communities, including parts of Greater Napanee. Grant's report recommends Council take a measured position, supporting nation-building infrastructure projects while endorsing the northern route as the option with the least disruption to local communities. The northern corridor, he said, would be shorter and faster and would avoid many of the impacts associated with the southern alignment, such as farmland, fragmentation, environmental disruption, and potential strain on emergency response routes. Grant noted that the project could bring broader economic benefits, including job creation during construction and increased demand in Canadian industries such as steel and manufacturing. However, he emphasized that those gains would largely be national in scope, with limited direct long-term benefit for Eastern Ontario communities not included in the planned service corridor. At the same time, staff acknowledged the region is unlikely to see direct service benefits. Current plans do not include a station in eastern Ontario communities such as Napanee or even Kingston, meaning the area could experience construction impacts without gaining access to the service itself. To address that gap, staff recommended Council advocate for improvements to existing rail options, including increased via rail frequency and the potential extension of GO Transit service east from Oshawa to Kingston. Some Council members voiced strong opposition to the project itself, not just the proposed southern route. Councillor Mike Schenk said he could not support the project, citing concerns about cost, farmland impacts, and broader economic priorities. Councillor Bill Martin echoed that position, saying he would be prepared to support a joint letter opposing the project entirely. Town Clerk Jessica Walters noted that the town had received numerous messages from residents about the project, though many of those messages arrived too late to be formally included in the meeting materials, underscoring the level of public concern, even as the ultimate decision rests outside of municipal control. The debate also underscores a broader misunderstanding shaping local reaction to the project. While Aalto has become the public face of consultations, it is the federal government, not Aalto, that controls whether and where the rail line is built. That gap between perception and reality has left municipalities navigating a complicated role, absorbing public pressure, participating in consultations, and attempting to influence a process where final authority lies elsewhere. Earlier this spring, Council heard from a local citizens group proposing an alternative approach, upgrading existing rail corridors to deliver faster service without building a new high-speed rail line. That proposal, presented as a cheaper and less disruptive option, underscored a key concern echoed again Tuesday night. Who benefits from the project, and at what cost to local communities? Grant told Council that feedback gathered from residents has already been shared with Aalto representatives, both verbally and in writing. However, he restated that those concerns will shape how the project is built, not whether it proceeds. Council also considered whether it is appropriate to take a position on the northern route, given that it would not directly pass through Greater Napanee. Mayor Terry Richardson questioned whether expressing a view on the route outside the town's boundaries would even be meaningful. Grant confirmed that if a northern route were selected, the municipality would likely no longer be included in discussions. He added that Aalto is not seeking input on that option from communities it would not affect. Still, the staff recommendation argues that expressing support for the northern corridor signals a preference for the least disruptive outcome should the project proceed. Following the discussion, Council agreed to defer the decision to a future meeting since two councillors, Angela Hicks and Bob Norrie, were not present to weigh in on the issue. The delay leaves unresolved how Greater Napanee will formally position itself on a project that could have significant local impacts, yet remains outside municipal control.
Thank you, Henry, and thank you to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little from CJPE County Radio about Mayor Steve Ferguson's decision not to seek re-election in Prince Edward County.
Last week, a select group of media personnel were invited to attend a special announcement at Shire Hall in Prince Edward County. Mayor Steve Ferguson declared he will not seek re-election in the upcoming municipal election. Since his appointment in 2018, Steve Ferguson has served two terms as mayor and has overseen a number of significant accomplishments. The reconstruction of County Road 49 has been a priority for decades, but federal funding was not forthcoming. With determination, Mayor Ferguson secured provincial funding for the project. A new hospital and long-term care facility, the acquisition of school property for affordable housing, and the implementation of financial relief programs are among the achievements during his tenure. Mayor Ferguson spoke with media about his time in office.
I have loved this job. It has been a terrific job. It has ticked all the right boxes for me. It's intellectually stimulating, emotionally stimulating. We're getting things done. What's not to like about it? It has been really rewarding, and I've worked with some great people, and we've accomplished a great deal, but the job has changed, and I don't know what's going to happen in this election, but I think it is going to be really, really, really rough.
What would your advice be to the person who drives in here on December 1st or after the oath of office and comes up the stairs and walks into the mayor's office? What words of advice would you have for them, and what would you say to them?
I would suggest that their greatest asset is going to be the dozens, hundreds of municipal employees, and to get to know them, get to know how they work, get to know the volunteer community, because anybody is going to absolutely need volunteers to make this place move forward. Mm-hmm. And those are starting points. It will also depend on the personality of the person coming in, but probably my biggest piece of advice is move forward. Mm-hmm. You can't look back. Mm-hmm. And so the county's changed. It has changed significantly since about 2015. Not earlier. And we have a terrific reputation. We have developed great relationships with upper levels of government. And we are recognized in both levels of government as a progressive municipality. And that I'm very proud of as well. But it's important to develop those relationships and keep moving forward, because there is no turning back. We're surrounded by 15 million people and within 2.5 hour drive. And we've got a lot of stuff that other people want.
What's next for Steve Ferguson?
Oh, I don't know, but it's not going to be retiring and doing gardening. I've worked since I was 12 years old, part-time, obviously. But as a student, I've just been, I've got to keep the loaf alive. That's a very big thing for me to do. So I don't know. But this chapter is coming to an end. I will say it is highly addictive. I'm sure I'll be involved in some minor capacity, whether it's provide advice or talk to people about the things I've experienced. I don't know.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Up next is Jesse Bell reading a story by Sarah Williams, LJI reporter for the Napanee Beaver, about the 2026 Sunderland Maple Syrup Festival.
Thank you, Dinah. Sunshine, syrup, and strong community spirit defined a successful weekend at the 29th annual Sunderland Maple Syrup Festival, as thousands of visitors filled the downtown core to celebrate one of Brock Township's most cherished traditions. The picture-perfect weather set the tone, with blue skies and warm spring sunshine drawing large crowds early in the day. Streets quickly filled with festival-goers browsing vendor stalls, enjoying live entertainment, and lining up for classic maple treats. The annual festival, which typically attracts more than 10,000 visitors, once again delivered a full slate of attractions, including a bustling vendor market, live music, family-friendly entertainment, and interactive demonstrations. A steady stream of visitors made their way through the Royal Canadian Legion for the ever-popular pancake breakfast, while others explored the many displays and activities hosted at Sunderland Public School and the local arena. Festival Secretary Ryan Williams said the weekend was a strong success from an organizer's perspective. Throughout the weekend, live entertainment kept crowds engaged, while demonstrations including blacksmithing, wildlife presentations, and maple syrup production tours highlighted the region's agricultural roots and craftsmanship. Signature events like the bathtub races on Saturday and Sunday's lawn tractor pull demonstration added to the festival's charm, while local organizers kept visitors well-fed with a wide range of food options. Despite some Sunday rain, organizers and attendees alike agreed the festival once again delivered on its reputation as a must-visit spring event. As another successful year wraps up, organizers are already looking ahead to next year's 30th anniversary edition, confident the sweet tradition will continue to bring visitors back to Sunderland for years to come. Thank you to Sarah Williams from the Napanee Beaver for that story. Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen reading a story from Keith Dempsey, local journalism initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about the retirement of Councillor Jeff Lackey.
Thank you, Jesse. Longtime Councillor Jeff Lackey formally said goodbye to Leeds and the Thousand Islands Council last Monday night, offering thanks, reflection, and a touch of humor as he closed a 15-and-a-half-year chapter in municipal politics. Lackey's recent resignation less than a year before municipal elections on October 26th triggers a succession process that will see his council colleagues choose who fills his seat for the remainder of the term. Speaking as a delegation towards the Township of the Leeds and Thousand Islands Council meeting last Monday, Lackey expressed gratitude to fellow members of council staff and residents who supported him through his tenure. Lackey, who first joined council in 2006, reflected on the township's growth and key milestones he witnessed and helped shape over the years. Among them were infrastructure upgrades in Lyndhurst, revitalization efforts along the Bay of St. Lawrence, the creation of a joint recreation group with the town of Gananoque, and the development of the township's recreation department. He also pointed to the township's first acquisition of a fireboat and his involvement in senior administrative decisions, including participating in the hiring of the current MPP Steve Clark during a brief term as the township's chief administrative officer. While stepping away from council, Lackey confirmed he will continue serving the community in a new capacity. His departure creates a vacancy on the Ontario Provincial Police Board representation, meaning another member of council will be appointed to ensure the township maintains its seat. Members of council took turns recognizing Lackey's contributions, with Councillor Brian Mabee calling it a privilege to serve alongside him. Deputy Mayor Terry Foti, visibly emotional, credited Lackey as a steady and guiding presence for newer council members. Foti also highlighted Lackey's longevity and dedication to residents, joking that the township should give him a permanent seat inside Escott Hall following its reopening so visitors could continue to benefit from his knowledge. Mayor Karina Smith-Gatsky described working with Lackey as a true pleasure, adding that his impact extended beyond council chambers. The province's Municipal Act allows a council to appoint a qualified person to fill a council vacancy. A notice on the township website invites qualified applicants for the council position to submit their names to township officials, with forms accepted until Wednesday, April 29th at 4 p.m. Council will hear from all applicants at its May 12th meeting. And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Ted Evans, LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, with a story on the 2025 numbers for the Amherst Island Recreation Association.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. The Amherst Island Recreation Association had a successful 2025, according to their recent presentation. Members of the association shared a review of their last year of operations at Loyalist Township Council's latest meeting. Chair of the association, Chelsea McDonald, spoke about the makeup of the association and their last year of operations.
We have a board of directors for our not-for-profit. There are 9 directors on our board with 3 executives. We have 10 volunteers, and we have program leaders and helpers. This year, we were able to have 2 paid instructors provide programs for us, and we were able to provide 13 programs in total. with a variety of participants ranging from 4 to 19 participants per program.
McDonald detailed their sports-related programming.
In the past, we've done a variety of sports-related programs. We find that Zumba is a really big popular one with everyone on the island, especially young moms and kids come out to enjoy that program. And this year, we were able to find another yoga instructor that is actually a community member, so someone local that's able to come out and provide yoga to the community. And that was another big accomplishment for us because it was a really good program. Volleyball has always been really popular with the young adults as well as some older adults. And we find that in the spring, we get a higher volume with university students coming back to play. In the fall, we actually changed it to 13 plus because we had some eager young students that wanted to join as well.
McDonald spoke about new programming in the last year.
The newest thing we were able to provide for youth this year was electronics. We had an island resident who reached out and wanted to teach robotics to the kids. So they had done a little bit in the classroom at school, but she really wanted to provide a camp. So we worked with her and were able to provide a 4-day camp in August for kids to learn about robotics. They made some really neat Christmas decorations that lit up and robots that moved. And it was so successful, she opted to start an actual club starting in September, where the kids go twice a month and they learn how to do coding and make more robots.
McDonald noted one of her favorite programs.
All Ages Sports Night is honestly one of my favorites because it's the kids come out to play. And we do a variety of different sports, from soccer to volleyball to pickleball to basketball. And the absolute favorite is dodgeball. And every week they ask if we can play dodgeball.
McDonald spoke about programming throughout the winter and spring.
Winter Walking Club is something that we provide to the community in the winter months. So from December to April, where the community has a safe space to walk and to socialize. One of my other favorites is youth art. So each spring, this is the third year we're doing it, we're able to provide a youth workshop for art with using local island volunteers to provide these classes. Last year, we did watercolor and pencil drawing and animation.
Treasurer for the association, Mike Walhout, spoke about their finances for the year.
We're running at a small deficit. We do fundraising and we kind of do it as needed. So we're making up the difference that way. This was our first year as well, so we had to get through the accountant and all the not-for-profit filing processes that are costly, and we're going to look at ways that we can save money and perhaps access some grants as well.
Councillor Lorna Willis shared her experience with the programming on Amherst Island.
The programming that we get to enjoy on the island right now is very special. And I was at one of the children's art programs the other day, and it's kind of fun to see all the kids getting together in the school after school voluntarily.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
And thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the CFRC Sports Update.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and I'm very pleased today to have in studio with me a veteran of the Queens women's football program, 4 years on the team, and a former CFRC volunteer as well. In studio today, I have Claire Chow. Women's football, it's flag, but there is a physical component to it. I believe, like, offensive and defensive line, that's basically full contact, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. So we played two different formats. The first one, the one that you're talking about, is contact flag football, mm-hmm. and that is essentially the exact same rules as tackle football. The only difference is that there's no tackling, but, like, jamming 5 yards off the line is allowed. O-line, D-line is full contact. Yeah, a little crazy on that. And then the 5v5 format, which is the format that's going to be played in the Olympics, mm-hmm. is no contact.
Speaking of the evolution of this Queens women's football team, you guys do play, obviously, like, the two different formats, but I know there's, like, 5v5. I think there's 11v11. Yes. What are the full set of teams for Queens women's football? And can you give us, like, a quick little update on how each of them did this last season?
Yeah, so this last season, our season for 5v5 started in the fall. And going into the tournament, our team was actually ranked last. Wow. Out of all of the teams. There were two tiers, and we were ranked last. which was pretty tough for us because we were placed in the lower tiers, so we had to really like fight our way up. Yeah, so that season was great. We had two teams in that. We had the gold team and the blue team. The gold team and the blue team started in the bottom tier, and then on the first day of playoffs, we played like play-in, so like we beat the top B-tier teams, and then we move up to the A-tier. It was just really awesome to see the growth of our skill throughout the season. So we actually went undefeated that season, the gold team, and ended up winning the championship. And then our blue team, which is supposedly the B team,
right,
finished fourth in the province, which is incredible. They just like, they finished fourth in the province. They beat most of the other schools, like A teams. It was awesome. It was so, yeah, it was just really cool to see. And like the success of the program is really, really taken off.
Can you talk about how your team has kind of progressed during your time from your first year to now this year as one of the veteran players? Like, what does that development look like?
Yeah, in my first year, it was definitely always taken seriously, but as time has gone on, we've just progressively gotten like more opportunity to be taken seriously and play really hard. So in my first year, it was kind of a little bit more relaxed. You know, we were kind of still coming out of that recreational phase.
Right.
So we took it seriously, obviously, but, you know, it just wasn't, I don't know, we didn't have like that edge yet.
Right.
So we kind of went through some things that season that kind of gave us a little bit of a chip on our shoulder. We ended up finishing third, I believe, that season, which is not bad at all. Like, not bad at all. That was in the 11v11 season. Mm-hmm. And then after that season, we had another 11v11 season, went through some more things, lost by 1 point to Western in the final. And that was, I think that's what really pushed us over the edge to become such an elite team. I think we needed to go through some adversity together. Year after that, 11v11, took it home, undefeated 11-0, pretty historical season for us. Year after that, this year, undefeated in the 5v5 season, undefeated in the 11v11 season, and then undefeated in 5v5 spring season.
And I believe this is the first time in the program's history that you guys have made it to the national finals.
Yes, correct. Last year we didn't go to the tournament that would have qualified for us for it because it was like 1 or 2 weeks after the 11v11 season, which was the same this year, but like we just decided we needed to do it. We needed to put our best foot forward and like go for it because we know we have the talent for it, and clearly we do.
Claire, how can the people listening at home support the women's football journey to nationals in Regina?
A donation link up on our Instagram page. As it stands right now, the club is self-funded, which means all of our student athletes and our coaches are paying out of pocket for this trip, which is really difficult because we don't receive a ton of funding from Queens. However, we are still extremely grateful for everything they've given us.
Of course.
But yeah, it really does put a pretty big financial strain on a lot of our players. So something that people at home could do is donate if you're able, and if you're not able, keep sharing our story, pushing it towards other people who might be able. And yeah, we really appreciate truly like everything. Like everything we are given or all the publicity we get and like all the support we receive, we're really truly grateful.
And that's Queens W Football on Instagram. Claire, before we wrap up, any final thoughts, anything else you want to tell the folks listening at home here?
Yeah, the team is just so grateful to be representing Kingston and Queens as a whole. It really truly has given us a home for the last couple of years of our university lives. Yeah, supporting women in sport, that's a big one. We just, our goal as a team is just to continue to inspire girls to, you know, chase their dreams, because we're kind of in a really male-dominated kind of niche of sport, and it's really awesome that we've made it here and we're able to keep pushing and keep inspiring those girls to do the same. So yeah, just really grateful for everything, really looking forward to the opportunity to compete at the highest level.
And thank you to Jesse Bell for that update. And also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Tuesday, April 21st, daytime high of 7 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. Going to feel closer to 3 degrees, so bundle up if you're headed outside. Wednesday, April 22nd, a little bit warmer. Daytime high of 11 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, but that 11 degrees is going to feel closer to 15 degrees out in the beautiful sunshine, dropping down to 4 overnight. Thursday, April 23rd, 11 degrees is once again your high, and it will once again feel closer to 15 in the sun, dropping down to 5 degrees overnight. Friday, April 24th, beautiful spring day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 15 degrees with a lot of bright sunshine, making it feel closer to 17, dropping down to 6 degrees overnight. Saturday, April 25th, 15 degrees is your high, but given the 85% chance of precipitation in the forecast, it's going to be a fairly humid day by spring standards, feeling closer to 18 degrees, dropping down to 5 overnight. And the amount of rain we get on Saturday means we've got a slight temperature drop on Sunday, April 26th, daytime high of 11 with a 60% chance of rain, going to feel closer to 8 degrees and drop down to 4 overnight. Starting off next week, Monday, April 27th, a beautiful 11-degree day, lots of bright sunshine, and that sun will make it feel closer to 16 degrees, dropping down to 5 overnight. And next Tuesday, April 28th, we have a forecast of 11 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to 13 degrees and dropping down to 4 overnight.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.
Grad Chat. Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. And it's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Dr. Amoon Jamzad, who is a postdoctoral fellow working in the School of Computing with Dr. Parvin Mousavi. Welcome to Grad Chat, Amoon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And you've got a lot going on research-wise, but before we dive into that, can you tell us a little bit about your journey so far and what attracted you to Queen's in the first place?
Oh, for sure. So I think my journey was truly multidisciplinary. I started my bachelor as an electrical engineer, so mostly into hardware and understanding of how electrons work. But then as I transitioned through more graduate studies, I wanted to have the applications on the medical side. So I started a master and PhD program on biomedical engineering. So it was it has two parts to it. One was changing the application to more medical related and also move a little bit toward data analysis. And then after that, for my postdoc period, I decided to jump into the data analytic parts more advanced and then go with the AI, because that was the time that AI was the big thing, which still is. That's how my work transitioned from pure hardware and electronics to AI and analysis of healthcare data. And the reason that I joined Queen's is, as you know, when you put the multidisciplinary research and you look at it, it's not possible without the collaboration between different people in different disciplines. And what Queen's provide is this opportunity. It is a true interdisciplinary environment that each person is not individually running a research. I, as a computer scientist, am part of a bigger team, consists of pathologists, engineers, clinicians, surgeons, and we work together in a collaborative way and we can make a difference. So I think that's the most important part, that the environment that we have at Queen's, that that's very rare. And this level of collaboration, and it's not about the technology, it's not about equipment, it's about willing of people that they want to collaborate with each other and they agree to come out of their comfort zone and see what's out there.
Yeah, because there's a lot going on in all of these different places, and it takes, you know, the skills and expertise of all your collaborators to make the projects actually happen. So your research involves
artificial intelligence, and a little bit of computer-assisted intervention, or maybe a lot of computer-assisted intervention. Can you tell us a little bit about what opportunities AI does to open up into cancer research, and what challenges does it need to address?
Yeah, for sure. So in a nutshell, what I'm doing is sit at the intersection of like AI and artificial intelligence and specifically cancer studies. Mm. So it has different application, the use of AI from understanding the cancer, from characterizing it to supporting decision making. But if I want to start from the artificial intelligence as a broader thing, it's all about decision making. Mm-hmm. So let's say you want to go to a meeting from home. So what you have to make a decision how you want to go there. So you need two things. You need information, and then you need to make a decision based on the previous knowledge that you had. Mm. For example, in that example, you probably may check Google Map to see what's traffic. You probably check what are the possible routes and what are the distances. Mm. You check the weather application to see, okay, how's the weather? Should I go by foot if it's a close distance, or I should get a car? You may check your time. Am I late? can I go and get a coffee and then go there? So all of those things are data part of it. So you're using different sources of information. Then the decision comes. So how you make that decision based on your previous experience. Mm. You probably visited this part of town before, so you know how the traffic works based on the time, based on this initial knowledge, you can make the hopefully best decision that you can be there on time and prepared, right? Mm-hmm. So AI is exactly the same because it is an artificial version of the intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. So the information part is data, and the decision making part is the model. So when we are talking about different modalities that AI can use, we are talking about that information. When we are talking about model and how we can train models and different property of the models, it is about that knowledge that based on previous information can make a new decision interpret. So in that scenario that I mentioned, the data seems to be very simple. You have different sources like traffic, time, and all of that. And then the decision is, when should I go? How should I go? So the worst case scenario is you arrive late, right? So hopefully you will not get any accidents. But when you bring it into the application of cancer, both of these parameters are changing. The data part getting lots and lot more complex. Mm-hmm. We have different sources of information when you're going to capture it to make a decision about a patient, especially cancer patients. Mm-hmm. So you can have imaging information. We have different modalities that can take an image, that each image capture different property. We can have normal cameras, for example, for skin analysis, or we can have cameras that actually visualize magnetic property of the body, acoustical property of the body. So all of these are trying to add another layer of information for you. Mm-hmm. And each of them has different component and its own complexity. And this is, you are getting information from humans. So it is not always the same. There's lots of variability. It's not zero and one like computers. So there are lots of challenge on the data side. The model part is also very challenging because when you're supporting the decision making, let's say you want to implement it in the surgery room, that the surgeon going to use it to help them better understand where cancer is and remove it, then the stake is very high. You have to make a good decision. The model is not going to say, okay, the worst case scenario, the cancer remains. That's not acceptable, right? So it's not just about having a precise model. You have to make the model trustworthy. You have to make the model handle uncertainty. So I cannot go into the OR and say, okay, surgeon, this is my model. When it says cancer, it's cancer. When it says normal, it's normal. You listen to it. They will throw me out of the OR because it should provide a level of understanding, a level of interpretation. It's not just, this is my decision, why you are making this decision. Because the most important part in my line of work that we should all agree upon is that AI models are not making decisions. AI models are supporting the decisions that are going to be made by the clinician. So that's very important to recognize. So that's the all of the opportunities and all of the challenges I can imagine for the AI in cancer research. Like the applications, if I want to go into that route, would be different. So you can use AI essentially to better understand cancer. You can use it to use previous information to understand the characteristic of cancer, how it's generated, what's the source of it. Then you can use it for treatment. You can implement something in the OR that when they use it to extract cancer and remove cancer from the body, they can use it to provide them with better information. You can use it for cancer monitoring after the cancer is out. Was it a successful surgery? Mm-hmm. How was the surgery? Can we evaluate it? So in all of these different application, AI can provide a potential help for the surgeons. And the data part, like, there are lots of different modalities that we are working with. One of the interesting ones that I'm going to talk about most about would be the mass spectrometry. Yeah, which is very interesting.
So what makes mass spectrometry so useful in cancer research, and where does AI become important? I think you've done a really great job of explaining, you know, some of the challenges and the ways that you can use AI, but where does AI and mass spectrometry kind of come together?
Sure. Mass spectrometry, I think it's a very exciting technology because in a nutshell, what it does is it provides you with the chemical fingerprint of the specimen. So the mass spec technology by itself is not a brand new technology. Mm-hmm. It was around for many, many decades. But it was sitting in the laboratories that you feed a specimen, you get the chemical kind of fingerprint, and you make a decision based on that. Mm. But recently, it was lots of like interesting work has been done to make the technology accessible through operating theaters, through the surgical units. So to explain that, I have to first talk about the cancer itself. So why it's interesting in cancer? The cancer, most of the time, when we want to decide if it's cancer or not cancer, let's go start with that. That's the responsibility of the pathologist. Mm-hmm. So the pathologist will put the tissue under the microscope, if we want to simplify it.
Yes.
I'm sorry. pathologist tells that it's a super oversimplification of what they're doing, but they cut the tissue, put it under the microscope, look at the tissue and look at the structure of the cells and make a decision that if this cell looks like cancer or not. Mm-hmm. That would be very simplification
of course,
the thing.
No.
what mass spec is doing is what's happening with cancer is not just a morphological change. It's not changing the look of the tissue. It's also changing the chemistry of the tissue. So if you be able to measure that level of information on top of the like visuals, on top of the morphological changes, that would be a huge additional information that you can use and help you to have a more certain decisions on the cancer. But how you can bring it to the clinical platform? So what's happening in the OR is for any cancer surgery, when they have to, like solid cancer we are talking about, they have to cut the cancer out of the body. So that's the procedure. They somehow plan it. They know where the cancer is. They aim for it. They go and cut around it and then bring it out. So what they're using most of the time is not a cold knife. They are using an electrical knife, which in reality, heating up the tissue. So rather than cutting, you can say it is burning the tissue. Mm-hmm. And byproduct of any burning would be a smoke. So, and that's why in all of the operating room, we have suctions on the knife that collect all of the smoke and bring it into the filter. So the clever idea here was, why we get rid of it if it's a byproduct of what we are burning? Why don't we analyze it? Mm-hmm. That was the aha moment for them. So they bring it, they set up a system that rather than connecting the tube to the filter, they connect it to the mass spectrometer. So they can analyze the smoke that is coming out of the body when they're cutting in real time and then provide the mass spec. So that was the big thing, because now you have a sampling tool without adding lots of like equipment into the current procedure. That's one of the important things if my engineering part of the brain want to be involved is, it's not about how you can get a better decision. It's about how practical it is. Mm-hmm. If I come up with a new device called Amun 101, let's say Amun 2007, if I come up with that device that it has a very strange procedure that you have to connect it very weirdly and get some information, although it may provide some information, it will not be practically usable. But what the mass spec in an intraoperative form offering is, the surgeon experience would not be any different. Mm-hmm. What they are doing is they're cutting the same way that they were cutting, but we are providing the additional information to them. Mm-hmm. And what AI comes into place is, it can understand and analyze and detect patterns within these signatures, these chemical signatures that may not be possible to see with naked eye, because the signal is very complex. Mm-hmm. You are looking at the distribution of thousands and tens of thousands of ions that exist in the tissue. We are not talking about the simple molecule. We are not talking about the single substance. We are talking about the biological tissue that can have different sources and can different variety. So the AI can be very helpful, but the challenges are, well, the data is complex. It's a kind of real-time situations. So all of the things that we mentioned about AI should help with the trustworthiness, with covering uncertainty. All of those things apply here, but it is a new modality that may not be very convenient. There are lots of AI models out there that are dealing with images. So I know, like, ultrasound images are different from MRI images, but at the core of it, you are dealing with the two-dimensional information, right? So in that sense, the mass spec data is somehow very different. So come up with AI solutions that can handle that and the, again, noisiness of the data. Another thing is with training. So a classical example of AI model training is you have AI model that differentiate between cats and dogs. So you feed it lots of cats and lots of dogs and say, learn, this is your experience. This is how cats look like, this is how dogs look like. And then now you get a new image and then said, okay, this is cat, this is dog. But assuming that scenario, if I train a model with cancer normal, now if you show it the image of an elephant, by design, you limit it that either it can say cat or dog. And both of them, are, so it's doomed to say the wrong thing, right? So the same goes for the AI model in clinical. So if I train a model with cancer versus normal, then what happened if the surgeon cuts a muscle? What happened if the surgeon cuts skin? And we see that sometimes the signature of a skin, for example, is very similar to the signature of cancer, or closer at least to the signature of cancer compared to normal. So that become an issue and we get lots of false positives. So all of those challenges are things that me as an AI scientist try to address, try to handle, and try to kind of come up with a solution that can handle this and give the best kind of answer from the AI model that the clinician can use and make the good decisions. Now, part of the deal is building up the tools, the AI tools that can help. But part of it is making it, again, accessible. How we can implement it actually in the OR. How we can do that translation, which for mass spec will come to the product that we recently released. It's called Mass Vision, and it is actually doing that.
Very cool. So you've designed Mass Vision. Can you tell us what this platform is and how it grew out of your research? I think I have a sense of it, but what does it do? How does it address all of these issues that you've just discussed?
For sure. Yeah, it's a Mass Vision is an open source platform, so it's totally free. It's interactive, so the users don't need to code at all. It's all of the AI functionalities, exploration functionalities, all available for the user with no computing knowledge, with no programming knowledge, to be able to analyze their mass spec data. So if I want to go a little back, I told you about one sort of like mass spec technology that we are having, which is analyzing the smoke as it's come. If I want to like have an analogy for it, it would be like a super nose. So in surgery, surgeons, rather than just looking at the information that's coming from imaging, they can use a sense of smell. So now I can smell the cancer, see where it is. That's good, but it's a sampling tool. There's another form of mass spec that we call mass spec imaging. So rather than connect the mass spec to the end of the cautery tool, that when they cut, it provides you with information as the time goes, so real-time sensing. We are providing with the imaging setup that you put the tissue on a stage, and then you move the tissue like in a grid, and then you capture the signature, chemical signature of each pixel. So you can imagine that it would be similar to the photo that you're taking with your camera. It has three channels, red, green, blue. That's how the sensor in camera work, right? So, and then by combination of red color, green color, and blue color, you create all of the different variation of colors, and that's how you create a kind of colorful image on your phone. It is somehow to that, but imagine rather than three channels, now you have tens of thousands of channels. So this is a very important technology, because now, on top of all of the complexity that we had with the chemical dimensions, now we add the spatial dimension into it. It has its good side and bad side. The good side is now for each of the molecules, I see a spatial distribution, how it is go from one location. So it is very localized. And it's very good when you have a piece of tissue and you want to do an analysis and you want to compare it with, let's say, pathology as a gold standard, right? So now you can have a one-to-one local. But again, the complexity is the issue. So you have to be able to address that. And who is actually working with that data? So I'm a computer scientist in cancer research, so I work with that data. I try to find solution. But in reality, the main people who are working with the mass spec imaging data are basic scientists, are molecular biologists. So how they are handling this massive, huge, complex data and then come to the conclusion? Because those are the main scientists. I can provide the tool, but those people are the ones who have to use it and come to the clinical conclusion, mm-hmm. come to the biological conclusion. I cannot do that. That's above my knowledge, right? So, and the gap that we understand and I understand, and that was one of the things that only can be there through the collaboration mm-hmm. between different mm-hmm. disciplines. So through this collaboration that we are having through different projects, I see that our biological collaborators are relying on somebody who knows how to code. Mm-hmm. Definitely, I was there to help. And whenever they come to me, I want to do this. Can you do this? For sure, it's possible. We can just change the code. But although it's good to have this collective kind of collaboration, mm-hmm. it should not be the way that remove the independent research. Mm. So what I understand is it's a barrier for them to do the research on the mass spec information independently. Mm. So we understand that gap and then we try to resolve it. So we said, all of these wonderful tools that I'm having that I have to code to get what I want, what if I use a platform that bring all of these and put a button interface, like user interface to it, so they can use it interactively without any coding knowledge.
Wow.
And not only that, that will give us to implement now additional capability that was not available in the previous software, add AI to it, and all of these in a free platform. So wow. that was the beginning of the origin story of Mass Vision. And what's happening with Mass Vision is, well, you have this huge data. Mm-hmm. The first step with the data, and this is a kind of important note for all of the people who are in the medical field and AI. The AI is a secondary thing. The first step is you have to understand your data. Mm. It is not cats and dog and like elephants and cars that everybody know. Medical data can be different. So you have to have a good understanding of the data. So everything starts with exploration of the data. Mm. What if I want to simplify my data, how it looks like? So Mass Vision provides you with lots of AI-based technologies that you can use and an algorithm that you can use to simplify the data. You can have different visualization that give you the best contrast of the things that you're looking for. So rather than looking at 10,000 ion image at the same time, you can simplify it to a simple visualization that give you all of the important points. Mm. And that make a discovery much easier. Then you can create your data set, because another thing that's important for any AI research is having a clean data set. So how you can say, this is my spectrum and this is my pathology label. Most of the platforms that are free cannot provide you with the multimodal environment that you can bring all of these together. So it become very hard. And the data set creation for the normal project could take like around 2 months.
Wow.
Now you can do that with Mass Vision in less than a week. So it's a huge difference in timeline, because it is now very convenient. Mm-hmm. And then for sure, the AI part, after you have your data set, you can do statistical analysis, you can do all of the fancy AI things that you want to do. And at the end of the day, it will help you to get what you want as a biologist, not necessarily as a computer scientist. And to give you a kind of idea about how successful was it, we released it, I think it was the last March 2025.
Okay.
And so far, we get more than 2,200 downloads worldwide. So it seems that it's
your tool is traveling far. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And it shows that it was something that was needed. And now we could provide it to the community. And I'm happy that they're using it. And it's the beauty of it is the platform that we are using is called Slicer. So Slicer is a platform for medical imaging, but we use the same platform to develop our Mass Vision platform. Mm-hmm. So the good thing about it is modular. So based on the community, based on the new requests that we are getting now from a larger community, rather than receiving instruction from our own group that I need this, and that was the base of the software. Now we can get requests from the larger community and then improve. So it is the improvement, and we are releasing more updates as we move forward and adding more functionality to make it more accessible for people.
Oh, wow. That's very, very cool. So it's gone from your very local collaboration between scientists and researchers and clinicians here in Kingston to global, and then you're getting feedback from global partners and then able to update the tool both to support local needs, but then also your global partners. So you're getting kind of this feedback that of continuous improvement, it sounds like.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. And the beauty of it is not just the software. It is the platform that bring all of the tools necessary. So lots of the needs are not necessarily simple AI stuff, mm-hmm. although we started with that. Now we are improving it because you want to have the bare minimum to start mm-hmm. with, and then you want to improve. But the modular capability gives us the lots of options. So we can add, let's say, previously we have lots of paper in advanced AI models to how to improve cancer detection. But mm-hmm. all of those was useful for us, but the reality is it's going to sit in a digital library and get a digital dust. Mm-hmm. But how to make it practical and how to make people use it? I can provide application on how or instruction on how to download the code, how to run the code. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, people, when they see the instruction, oh, I have to code, I have to like install it. So let's not do that, right? But if you can put it into a platform that does it interactive for you, then that feeling, that barrier feeling, it may be a feeling, you know, mm-hmm. it's using ChatGPT nowadays, making lots of things possible. Like you can say, okay, this code is not working, what should I change? Oh, this. So you can go still with having long emotional conversation with ChatGPT to make something work. But then this would, I said, the key theme is accessibility. So mm-hmm. what I'm trying to do is make all of those wonderful research that we are doing also accessible for the end users. Mm-hmm. So as another aspect of the research that we are doing here.
Oh, this is very exciting, and I'm glad that it's going so well. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave us about what makes this kind of research that you're doing possible?
For sure. As I mentioned earlier, we are working with definitely high-tech tools and high-tech toys to get what we want. But I think the key part is that technology by itself is not enough. Mm. You need people, and you need smart people. And smart people know the collaboration is a key. It is, you can still have people who want to learn everything, want to have all of the knowledge, and this is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, the groundbreaking findings are coming from people not directly in the field, but from the time that people from different fields collaborate, share ideas, and they find something interesting that can work for both of them. So I would say, these research, any kind of like multidisciplinary research, especially when you're combining AI with cancer research or any healthcare mm-hmm. kind of application, it's very important to have that mentality, have that collaboration. And these like people with different, from different disciplines, with different expertise, when they learn how to communicate, when they learn how to share idea, when they're open to the communication and collaboration, then lots of wonderful things are happening. And I would say this is one of the privilege that I had being in this group and part of this huge group in Kingston and Queens.
Oh, well, no, that's, well, yes, just thinking about some of the people you mentioned, it sounds like this is a gigantic team and it's always expanding as people learn more and then want to contribute to making improvements or adding different functionalities and modalities to the platform.
Exactly, exactly. But one of the saying that I have when we get a new student is, you may think that computer scientists are like sitting in front of the computer 24/7 coding. Mm-hmm. I said, when you're in the medical application, you should not be a coder only. You should be a field agent. You should be open to the idea to go to the hospital, interact with different disciplines, even interact with patients when it is accessible, when it's appropriate, to better understand. Because if you know the source of the information, the flow of the information, the people who are using that information, that will give you a way better idea. And then when you want to apply all of the AI knowledge that you're having, you can apply it way better, that that you build a useful product for those end users. Mm-hmm. So my fellow researcher, be a field agent, not sit in front of the computer. That's also healthier. So.
Yes, it is important to get out of the lab or off of your computer every now and then, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it sounds like you're incredibly busy with the research you're doing right now and with Mass Vision, but I hear that you also stay pretty busy outside of the lab with your family. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you've been up to with your family these days?
Yeah, I'm a full-time dad. Yeah. So. So the mornings are mainly my wife and I working, and then the afternoons are pretty condensed playing with our three-year-old daughter.
Oh, my three-year-old, yeah, that is busy, busy, busy.
Busy, and lots of experience. This is the opportunity for me to learn new things. I'm dancing, I'm singing, I'm learning new musical instrument, I'm painting a lot. playing with Play-Doh. So all of those things that I wanted to find an excuse to do. I have the best excuse and best playmate to do that. So it's very amazing. And for a person who is in the field of AI, because again, this is artificial intelligence, so it is come from actual intelligence. So when you see your kid grow up, when you see your kid learn, all of those things that we learn in the concept of AI, you see that that is actually the real thing. So when we are talking about training a model, when we are talking about how the model reacts with the environment, how the new information is received, how even the order of information that you're providing to a model can make a huge difference. So all of that, I can see that the way that my kid is growing up and learning these new things, I see, this is the same thing that we are using, but this is already in the nature. And this is already coded there. Yeah. So, what we are doing is actually understanding, it should be another way around, to be honest. You should understand that first and then go, so I can implement it here. But, well, the stream of knowledge, and it's so fast-paced that...
And I can only imagine how quickly little ones pick things up and learn things before you even realize that you've accidentally taught them different things and habits, right? They learn all those things. Well,
exactly.
Amun